The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Earlier this spring, graphic videos began airing on television stations near U.S. Air Force bases, showing the smoking debris of overseas villages and the charred remains of children.
U.S. drones have murdered thousands, including women and children. Drone pilots, please refuse to fly.
The videos were created by No Drones, that's K-N-O-W Drones, a group dedicated to achieving an international ban on drone warfare. The video campaign comes at a time when the Air Force is facing a steady drop in the number of pilots trained to fly drone missions. It's part of a trend that some have called drone fatigue. And here to tell us more is Pratap Chatterjee. He's executive director with CorpWatch. That's an investigative journalism group. Pratap wrote an op-ed on drone war burnout for the New York Times. And Pratap Chatterjee, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have accurate numbers of how many drone strikes have been made by the U.S.?
The United States doesn't publish the number of drone strikes that have been undertaken in the U.S. war on terrorism. On the other hand, there are nonprofit groups that have tracked this. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London, where I once worked, has kept track of confirmed strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And to date, they've counted 646 strikes. Now, that's not the full extent of it, because the U.S. Air Force, NATO, for example, do drone strikes in Iraq, Afghanistan, as part of conventional warfare. There's also coalition airstrikes, drone strikes in Syria. So the 646 number is definitely a lowball number.
So we have this idea that drone operators are playing with joysticks in air-conditioned rooms miles or even continents away from the battlefield. What I'm hearing from you is much more sort of direct involvement with the targets for some of the people who are in this drone program.
Well, it's a very complex system. So the video footage of a person on the ground or people on the ground is streamed back pretty much real time. There's a very slight delay, but it, you know, uplinks from the, let's say, the Predator or the Reaper drone to a satellite, and then it bounces through a variety of mechanisms to Nevada and to Florida. But there's a lot of people involved in this. There's pilots, often in Nevada. There's analysts who could be here in California where I live. They could be in Florida. There are commanders, often in the Middle East, in Qatar. And then there are recovery pilots, let's say in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia. So there's a lot of people involved in this. And some of them, it's their job to not just watch this in real time, watch multiple fields real time, but also go back over historical footage to see if they're tracking the right people. So it's a complex and difficult environment. But I think perhaps what's even more taxing on them is the fact that there's so few people that are trained that, in fact, they often have to work many hours at a time. They work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, you know, months on end. And so this overwork and the stress, bouncing between watching somebody in Pakistan and then, let's say, you know, clocking off and then going to pick the kids up from school, has created enormous mental fatigue for these drone operators, particularly the youngest among them, according to Wayne Chappelle, who's an Air Force psychologist who's been studying this for about 5 years.
And these are relatively low-level workers, right?
Absolutely low-level workers. The imagery analysts, the people who are responsible for analyzing the footage, are typically at the bottom of the food chain. And this is what they've been telling me in my conversations with them. I'm not hearing so much from the pilots, and the Air Force psychologists are not hearing as much stress or burnout among the pilots. It's higher than regular pilots, but they're hearing the most from the youngest among them, mm-hmm. who are literally 19 and 20, who have less than a year of training. Typically, it's 2 months of boot camp, 9 months of intelligence training. Within 12 months, they're on the job. And there was a recent report by the GAO, the Government Accounting Office, where they actually did not a definitive survey, but they surveyed a bunch of drone pilots. And they found that only 35% of them had actually completed training.
The organization you mentioned, the GAO, and the internal Air Force memos also revealed that drone pilots are indeed leaving the job in record numbers, citing stress and PTSD in many cases. The history of war is also the history of how technology is used, and this is a technology that's been used for relatively few years. From the psychologists that you spoke to, is there any attempt to create new ways to help not just pilots, but all of the associated personnel to deal with the psychological effects of drone warfare?
So drone warfare, killing people by remote control, really sort of begins in 2002 with the strike in Yemen. And now, you know, the pace has picked up in the Obama administration, who have really pioneered this technology. And the designations of who is what's called an RPA, remotely piloted aircraft pilot, or imagery analyst, these are brand new jobs that have been created literally in the last 5 years. So it's true that they have not provided psychological support. The Air Force is now providing what they call human performance teams. They're providing chaplains, they're providing ergonomic experts, because these people are working 12 hours a day. They're getting burnout, not just from watching images on the ground, but from using the equipment. And they're providing psychologists in the field on the floor of where this takes place. It still doesn't erase, you know, the images of people dying. And one of the things that very few people experience in conventional warfare is seeing your victim bleed to death in front of you, seeing them drag themselves, or even the person you're trying to save, if it's a soldier, seeing them drag themselves off across the field. You see not just what happened to them then, 5 minutes later, an hour later, but for days later. You see their funerals, you see their relatives, you see their wives, their children. So you see a lot more. And so it's a very different world where, in fact, these pilots are experiencing war up close and personal in a way that few soldiers ever experienced in the past. So it's much more in your face, so to speak. So the Air Force is trying to deal with that. I think, in fact, the issue is not so much about purely treating the pilots, but also addressing the issue of people on the ground. The drones, because they're overhead all the time, are driving people mad. And no less a person than the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency and former head of intelligence in Afghanistan, Michael Flynn, has said that this drone war is actually counterproductive. So it's not just about treating pilots, it's about treating the people that live under them. It's in fact a very flawed program to begin with.
Well, this is an op-ed that you wrote, after all, in the New York Times. What are you advocating for? We can hear what you're against, I think. What are you advocating for?
What I'm calling for in the New York Times op-ed is for the pilots to come forward and tell us what they actually personally experienced, because they know. And I think hearing from them directly is something that would provide the transparency that the Obama administration has refused to give us.
Pratap Chatterjee, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Pratap Chatterjee, he's executive director of CorpWatch. It's an investigative journalism group, and he's co-author of the forthcoming graphic novel, Virax. You can find more on Pratap's work, including his op-ed from the New York Times, by going to wordofmouthradio.org. In 2013, a bill drafted in the New Hampshire House proposed restrictions on drone use to protect people's privacy. During public hearings for the bill, several organizations took issue with its broad language. Among those objecting were the original drone enthusiasts, members of remote control airplane clubs. Well, we were interested in learning more about these old school flyers. So last year, we sent producer Zach Nugent to a hobby shop in Windham to speak with members of the New Hampshire Flying Tigers RC Club.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm Bill.
I'm Zach.
Hey, Zach.
Nice to meet you.
My name's Bill Horton. I own this, the hobby shop. It's called ABC RC and Hobbies, and we sell all kinds of RC products.
Let me get it so I can ring it up.
A kid that I hung out with and myself saw somebody that had a model airplane that flew, and it fascinated us, and we sort of got together, and we had very little parental help. We figured everything out ourselves. I crashed several planes trying to teach myself, and then probably about 12 years ago, I decided I wanted to go back in and learn to fly, so I joined a club, and learn to fly.
Crashes are common. My name is Paul Lockwood. I live in Londonderry. When I was learning, in fact, my nickname was Lucky because I managed to crash three planes within about a three-week period while learning to fly.
The speed on that thing is almost 200 miles an hour. Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah. The flip answer for why I got into the hobby is probably that as I considered retirement, my wife said I better find a hobby or she'll kill me. Our club has members literally ranging in age from 11 to close to 90.
There with you. One watching this away and one watching this away. Because
and a young pilot
speed,
with good eyes.
At that speed, you can't judge where that thing is at. I can't. I mean, I'm 80 years old. I can't judge where I'm at.
My name is Bob Kilman. I live in Nashua. I started in this hobby in 1957. I've always, even as a really, really young kid, I've always loved aviation. And I've been in it ever since. I like everything about the hobby. I like flying. I like building. I like the friendship that we have. I like helping people. I just like everything about it.
This is the latest rage, the quadcopters. And this is a small one. It comes with a camera.
Oh, wow, it's really small.
Controller, it's all self-contained, ready to fly.
And it comes with a camera, you said?
Yeah. See the little camera down there?
Yeah.
My name's David Johnson. I'm from Methuen, Mass. I'm a member of the Hampshire Flying Tigers up in Derry. A few of us used to fly combat, RC combat. We use these planes called Gremlins. They're basically almost like a flying wing. And you put a ribbon on it. You put a 15-foot string and a 15-foot ribbon. Then you go up there and you try to cut the ribbons. You do it by points. You know, you get a point for a cut. But also, the person gets the point if two planes collide and they're both crashing. You try to keep yours up in the air because the last one to crash actually gets the point. So these things could be tumbling out of the air and these guys are still trying to control them and keep them up.
You can fly this right over somebody's house. That's a quad.
Our flying is having fun together. I've gone to the field some days and not even flown. I just sit up there and visit and enjoy the outdoors.
Sounds nice. I might have to come watch.
Yeah, you ought to come up to the field sometime. You're always welcome. Everybody's welcome. Just come up.
The North Carolina Department of Transportation has hired its first official to oversee the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, usually referred to as drones. The state is also developing a mandatory test and permit system for commercial and government drone operators. It's all part of an effort to prepare for new federal regulations expected to open the nation's skies to commercial drones sometime in the next year. Producer Jay Price reports on the state of unmanned flight in the state where powered flight first began.
Tom Zukowski is getting ready to launch the future of aviation over a cornfield just south of Raleigh.
I'm tightening the launcher elastics right now. And then we're going to check and make sure everything's free and clear.
Zukowski is the flight operations manager for a tiny nonprofit group that, for now at least, oversees nearly all the commercial and government drone flights in the state. The Next Gen Air Transportation Center is based at North Carolina State University. It works with researchers, government agencies, and private companies to help them get up to speed with drones before the expected boom.
One, two, three.
And there it goes. The rubber strap yanks the toy-like foam-winged plane up a ramp and flings it into the sky. Kyle Snyder, who heads the NGAT, watches nearby as the plane turns and begins passing methodically back and forth over the cornfield, snapping photos. His group has special FAA permits to use several test sites around the state, and it flies almost daily.
So the idea behind these practice flights is collecting data to look at, you know, how safe and what are the rules we need to put in place for using these things on a daily basis, right? The flight performance data, we share all that with the FAA. But the flight data looking at the crops, we've got one of our ag partners here today that's looking at yield predictions for corn.
Farmers are one of many groups that are eager to use drones. The State Transportation Department wants them for road surveys and bridge inspections, and at least one town plans to use them to monitor construction projects. Soon, they should all be able to fly without special permission when the federal and state governments end their moratoriums on most commercial and government drone flights. The state is rolling out a permit system, including a test. It's not designed to assess flying skills, and recreational flyers won't have to take it. But Chris Gibson, the new DOT drone officer, says it's designed to ensure operators know the laws that apply to what he calls unmanned aerial vehicles.
One of the things that people need to understand is if there's a law in the books that specifies something as a crime, just because you use a UAV doesn't mean that all of a sudden it's not a crime. So we have peeping Tom laws, for example, right? You can't go looking in your neighbor's windows. Well, you can't do that with a UAV either.
That's a pretty obvious way that somebody can use a drone for mischief. But many experts expect drones also will raise unforeseen issues and require changes to laws. Sarah Preston is policy director for the ACLU of North Carolina.
As the technology improves, they could get smaller and smaller and therefore less and less noticeable. So whereas you would maybe notice a helicopter hovering over your property, you're less likely to notice something that's maybe the size of a bird and that doesn't make a lot of noise.
Preston says the state's drone law, which went into effect last year, leaves too much potential for abuse. For one thing, it allows law enforcement agencies to fly drones over public gatherings, even on private property. She says they could even use facial recognition technology to identify people at, say, a political meeting or even a neighborhood barbecue.
This is sort of an exciting new technology, but figuring out exactly how to use it and how to use it properly and safely, there's still a lot to be done there.
Law enforcement, though, is only part of what local governments are planning to do with drones, and just a small part for some of them. A couple of years ago, the town of Mooresville bought a small hovering-type drone for about $1,000. It wanted aerial images of renovations to a town golf course for its website. Before long, though, the town was also using it for things like getting crowd counts at street fairs. And town manager Erskine Smith envisions using it to help track public works projects, find lost people, and maybe even give firefighters a bird's eye view.
It's a very inexpensive tool that, you know, they always say a picture's worth a thousand words. And this is certainly an easy way to allow people to understand that you're going to build a road from here to here and get an idea of, oh yeah, now I know what they're talking about.
Mooresville had to mothball its drone because the state put a temporary moratorium on their use by local governments. That will end after the state permits are available and after the federal government implements its own regulations. But the town found the drone so useful that it applied for special permission to get it back in the air sooner. That kind of eagerness doesn't surprise people in North Carolina's fledgling drone industry. Thomas Hahn is vice president of strategy for a Raleigh company called Precision Hawk.
The market opportunity for UAVs is quite large. There are estimates that the United States is in the hundreds of billions of dollars of market size in the future.
Red Hat founder Bob Young helped start the company, which just outgrew its headquarters. It makes drones, but focuses on sophisticated analysis of the data that they gather. Precision Hawk already does business in other countries where drones are free to fly, and Hahn is eagerly awaiting a wide-open market here.
When the final rule is made into law, we will see tremendous growth, primarily in agriculture, insurance, and energy.
Take your antenna and put it up.
Put it up?
Yeah, put it up.
One of the company's main markets is in agriculture. That's because the data that the aircraft gather can be used to help farmers do things like monitor pests and diseases and help them use less seed, herbicides, and pesticides and boost harvest size. So it's no accident that Snyder's team is flying over a cornfield. Drones can do a lot for corn. And as it turns out, the corn has something to offer drones in return, a soft landing place.
There we go.
This plane doesn't have landing gear, so sometimes the operators intentionally fly it into the field. I'm Jay Price, reporting.
And now just one more story of things up in the sky before we move on. Sri Lanka has made a tentative deal with Google that could provide the entire nation with internet access. It's all part of a project called Loon, the details of which are a little hard to believe. For a few years now, the tech giant has been developing a network of high-altitude balloons that could, in theory, provide blanket internet access to remote areas down below. Here's Project Loon leader Mike Cassidy talking about the technology in a documentary made by The Verge.
The way Google X works is we try to prove that it can't work. So the first thing we did was took a router, flew it on a weather balloon up to 10 kilometers and see if you could still get a signal. And that part worked. And since then, it's been a continuous process of trying to stretch the envelope a little bit more every time to see how far it would go.
Mike Cassidy there, leader of Google's Project Loon. Google hopes to be able to start launching balloons by March of 2016.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Want to know what scares baby boomers more than dying? Losing their minds. That's right. The prospect of being cold in the grave is more appealing than needing to hire somebody to help you put on your socks or feed you ice cream. Americans spend more than $1 billion a year on cognitive classes and computer games to increase brain fitness. They take fish oil and ginkgo biloba and eat a Mediterranean diet and still find themselves unable to remember the name of that guy who was in that movie with that other guy. Patricia Marks is staff writer for The New Yorker. She set out to investigate whether all that stuff works. And she is pretty darn smart and also really funny. And so is her book, Let's Be Less Stupid. Patricia Marks, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
When do our brains start to lose their tone?
In your 20s, when you don't even need to be that smart, all you need to know is how to open the beer can, your brain is sort of cooking the best. And by around 27, it starts to shrink. That doesn't mean there aren't benefits to getting older, even mentally. And one heartening thing I read is that millennials actually forget their keys and what day it is more than the 50-year-olds and up.
Really? So there is hope?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It might be that they don't have keys and they don't care what day it is. But there is hope.
Well, the brain is elastic and cognitive rejuvenation is possible. That's one of the things you learned. Now, I thought that cognitive capacity was pretty much formed at an early age. It is not finite?
No. And in fact, your long-term memory isn't finite. Until a few decades ago, they thought that the brain was not plastic and that you had a certain number of neurons and like water evaporating, it just drip, 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 went away. And then, you know, then your caregiver had to show you how to tie your shoes. But now they know that you actually grow neurons and it's really about neural connections and that everything you do is changing your brain.
How about alcohol, drinking alcohol? That was a big
thing. Oh, this is really good news. Alcohol does not kill neurons unless you drink so much that you die, and then that's probably the least of your problems. However, it does do some damage to your dendrites, which are really important in communicating information from one neuron to another. So it's as if the internet went down in your brain.
So did you find yourself drinking more during the writing of this book?
Absolutely, can't you tell? I learned lots of good cocktail party tidbits. It's true that teenagers with IQs of 125 drink twice as much, I think, as teenagers who are not quite as smart.
Okay, we cannot let that bit of news get out there.
I know. It's as if the subtitle should be just drink up. But I don't know why that is.
How about blueberries?
Blueberries are good. It's pretty much everything that is good for your body is good for your brain, because guess what? They're connected. And the corollary of that is everything that is really boring is good for you.
Really? So like what?
Well, exercise and naps and meditation and salmon.
Well, there are plenty of things, obviously, that we should remember. You know, how to get somewhere. I suppose we don't need to anymore with the GPS, but
guess what? It turns out that if you rely on the GPS, and who doesn't, the GPS part of your brain shrinks a little.
Well, I guess that's part of my thought, that can't we make an argument that there is just too much to remember now? I mean, we have so much more information than we used to. What did you find about that?
There's a very optimistic theory by a guy named Ramsar. He said, the reason we're getting stupider is that we're getting smarter. There is so much information overload now, as you know. For instance, and this wasn't Ramsgar, this was somebody else, I think Levitin, said that we absorb the equivalent of 174 newspapers a day, which is five times what we had to take in 1986. And by the way, by we, I don't mean I, because I am not taking in 174 newspapers. The other thing that's just, like, staggering is that in the last 2 years, we've produced 90% of the world's information, more information than was produced from the dawn of civilization to 2003. So how can we remember that? So in my book, I tell about things that we should really forget.
So like what? What should we unremember?
Well, everything we learned in school, for one thing. I mean, the Dewey Decimal System, we don't have to know, sentence diagramming, microfiche. And then there are people like Wesley Snipes, Charo, we don't have to know about. The floor plan of the Brady Bunch house, delete.
Can you exercise your brain and make it smarter, like you can firm up your thighs or your pecs? Well, Patricia Marks is a humorist and staff writer for The New Yorker, and her attempt to get her brain into 22-year-old fighting shape using computer brain games and meditation and learning language and playing music and even electrocranial stimulation and other arduous methods somehow come across as funny in her new book. It's called Let's Be Less Stupid. When you were on your brain fitness regime, mm-hmm. you did get an fMRI to establish your brain health. Now, what did you see initially?
Well, I should say that I spent 4 months doing everything possibly that I could tolerate that they said might be good for your brain. And before and after I did that, I had my brain imaged with fMRIs and MRIs, and I had my IQ taken.
So what did those reveal?
All right, let's start with the IQ test. Before I had it professionally taken, I took a few tests online because there are all these free tests online. Though they're not really free because you have to pay to get the results. And I took one, and I'm thinking, God, my mother was right. I am so smart. I am just acing this. This is so easy. And then I clicked to get my results, and I have an IQ of 74, which, you know, means that, like, I'm an overachiever just because I can tie my shoes. And I realized that that the test was timed. And I never knew that. That day, I just, you know, sort of did one of the tests, and I went and voted for the mayor. Then I did one of the tests, and then I had lunch. And now, you could argue that anybody who fails to read the directions deserves an IQ of
74. Maybe that's the trick question there.
But then I had it professionally taken, you know, by someone who required you to bring number two pencils. And I can't really reveal what happened.
Because
you know, that would kill the suspense. But I will say that when I had my brain imaged, and I had never had MRIs before, and I really like getting an MRI. And I got the pictures back, and there were, like, lots and lots of areas that had expanded. The technician told me that my brain had expanded 33% in many areas. And I showed that to my boyfriend, who's a scientist. And he laughed and just said, if that were true, your brain would now be oozing out of your ears and your eyes, and it's not. But lots of areas were lighting up that hadn't been lighting up. But even that's questionable. They did a study where they took a dead salmon, put it in an MRI machine, showed the dead salmon pictures of faces, and asked the dead salmon what each picture conveyed emotionally. And wouldn't you know it, they got some sort of brain activity.
So I mentioned some of the things that you tried. What do neurologists say about exercise and brain function?
Well, this was a really disappointment to me because I love sitting down. I really don't like exercise. But exercise is great for you. In addition to it resulting in more blood getting to your brain, which prevents strokes, it actually changes the shape of your brain for the better, and it stimulates the production of good proteins as opposed to bad proteins, which help neurons communicate with one another. So it's altogether good. But there's really good news on the horizon because scientists are developing a pill that they say will mimic the beneficial cognitive effects of exercise without even leading to sweating. Essentially, the pill contains a hormone, FNDC5, that basically prods the expression of factors which activate genes that are involved in learning and memory. So all you have to do is down the pill, sit back, and get smarter.
You also tried meditation, which it's been proven to do what for the brain?
Essentially, meditation reduces stress, and stress is bad for the brain. Stress is necessary if, say, there's a tiger running after you and you have to have enough adrenaline to run from the tiger or get a taxi and tell him to get you away from the tiger. But in normal circumstances, you don't need to be producing those chemicals. And yet we do. We stand in the line that says you're allowed to have 10 or less items, and the guy in front of you has 11, and you just are so upset, or at least I am, that basically my brain is fighting the tiger. So meditation helps you reduce stress, and it helps the brain.
Can you tell us, do you feel smarter?
I feel kind of less worried about my brain than I did. And one of the reasons is that for every study that says you can do this, there's a study that says, no, that's wrong. So I'm a fatalist, and I like to believe, well, whatever's going to happen, happens. I also learned that Alzheimer's is different than just forgetting where that thing is or where your keys are or what the name of that thing is. It doesn't mean that before long you are going to start putting toothpaste on your contact lenses. So I felt more confident that I wasn't necessarily going to get Alzheimer's just because I couldn't think of that word. And I also feel less worried because I thought, well, if I'm going down, everybody's going down with me. Your brain does get a little rustier, and even if there are things you can do about it, you don't have a 20-year-old brain, but you're wiser.
Patricia Marks, thank you very much for speaking with
thank
us.
Thank you. This was fun.
Patricia Marks is staff writer for The New Yorker. She's a former writer for Saturday Night Live and author of Let's Be Less Stupid, An Attempt to Maintain My Mental Faculties. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Television viewers have likely fried their own brains by seeing dozens of autopsies. Well, coming up, a journalist witnesses a real postmortem and gets some insight on their value to the medical profession. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I was just about to check the contents of the stomach anyway. Something's embedded in the stomach lining. Looks like a microchip.
May I see that for a second?
A clip there from NCIS New Orleans, one of several crime procedurals that have made death, gore, and gristle common on television. With their spunky pathologists and well-lit labs, these shows reduce the emotional freight of death to just blood, bone, and tissue. What they don't do is prepare even seasoned viewers for the shock of facing real corpses during a real autopsy. Rachel Wilkinson attended an autopsy at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and wrote about it for The Atlantic. And Rachel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you end up in an autopsy room at UPMC?
Well, I was actually in a medical writing class. It was not easy. I didn't start out, in other words, sort of planning to go to an autopsy, but I met the full-time hospital pathologist at UPMC, Dr. Jeffrey Nine. I met him, and within the span of about 5 minutes, he said really reverent, beautiful things about his job, and then at the same time sort of made a really funny joke. And I thought, okay, there's something weird going on in this room where they're navigating between the sacred and the profane, and I knew I wanted to get in and see it. So I did sort of a dry run where I saw the room and there was nobody there. And then I went when they didn't have a case, and then they got me in to see an actual case.
So that's a teaching hospital, correct?
Correct.
How often do they conduct autopsies at UPMC?
Because it's not like NCIS, so it's not homicides. It's whenever someone has a relative die in the system and the next of kin elects to have that autopsy performed. So it comes out to about one a day, a little less, or about 350 a year.
Well, they are part of the formula on many police and crime shows. So what are some of the ways that autopsies as seen on TV differ from the real thing?
A forensic autopsy, you're trying very hard to sort of look at it from a legal perspective, and it usually has to be done quickly, and you're trying to get information out, sometimes to lawyers, to other doctors, whoever. Whereas hospital autopsy, they assume the cause isn't homicide. And so in a big teaching hospital like UPMC, they take a lot more time. Mm-hmm. So on NCIS, they can do 40 minutes an hour per autopsy, and you're going to have multiple bodies per day coming in. But the one a day of just sort of natural causes in the hospital system, they can take their time. And because it's students working, they can take up to 6 hours to do that.
Wow. Were you the only person there attending for the first time?
Yes.
So students are usually, they're pretty well seasoned in this. Did you get any warning or tips for how to prepare?
I was told it's totally acceptable to faint, and that trained professionals, medical students, everybody faints. And so to be prepared for whatever natural reaction my body was going to have. And some of the really new people, they told me the smell is sometimes the hardest part. So they will wear like Vaseline under their noses. I said, no, I'm going to do it all in, all natural. And it wasn't as bad as I thought.
And you didn't faint.
Didn't faint.
Did you know anything about the identity of the person that you were witnessing the autopsy on?
Because of privacy reasons, they kind of wanted to hide his identity as much as possible. So basically all I knew was his general age range, his time of death, and what they thought the cause of death would be. But other than that, I didn't know his family, his job, where he was from, any of that.
Now, they put, something over a sheet or something to cover his face during the autopsy. Do they normally do that, or was that just for your purposes?
You know, I was thinking about that, actually. I think it was in deference to me, but I don't know if they suddenly realize, like, oh, there's this visitor in the room and maybe we should defer to her, or if it maybe is something they do in some cases. It was such a lovely moment that I kind of didn't ask at the time.
A lovely moment. What do you mean?
The interesting thing, I think, is when you step into the room, everything is immediately routinized. It's hard in some ways to have an emotional reaction because everybody is at work doing their jobs, running around. And so everything is kind of scientific and accounted and present for. But then there are these little moments where you realize, oh, like, here's what we're actually doing. And so they were very much in the middle of just procedure and talking and teaching. And it all seemed, in this strange way, very ordinary and banal. And then suddenly we're called back into the reality of, oh, this is a person. This is a dead body in the room with a face. Mm-hmm. And so when they did that, it was this really nice act. I felt that paid homage to where we were. And then immediately after that, we were kind of back in the investigation part of it. And the oscillation between those two things is what I found so fascinating.
Many of us have witnessed autopsies in quotes on programs like NCIS or other crime procedurals. Well, I'm speaking with Rachel Wilkinson, who attended one for real at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and wrote about it for The Atlantic magazine. Well, your description of Dr. Jeffrey Nine, he's the pathologist that was conducting the autopsy you attended. I don't know, it almost made him sound like one of those TV characters, you know, throwing out really good one-liners 1 minute and then expert analysis the next. What was he like as a guide?
He was exactly like that. Extremely competent and could jump in and do anything. And yet he clearly was trying to keep it, you know, it seems almost crass to say like fun and light for the students, but there was an element of that. And then a fun fact about him that did not make it into the article is he is also a seminarian.
Really?
He is, I think, a Presbyterian minister on the weekends. And so another pathology stereotype is that they're kind of low on emotional intelligence, but he's actually known for being incredibly empathetic and communicative with families. So he can wear so many hats. And so he's, needless to say, really fantastic at his job and navigating all those different things.
Well, pathologists also have a rap, I think, for being, you know, a little bit creepy. You know, somehow their work is macabre or kept underground. What did you learn about their work?
I mean, I think I came to sympathize with them that I had no idea what a pathologist was beforehand, and then came to realize how essential they are to the medical profession and also how hidden, because it is true that if the person biopsying a cancer sample and telling you whether it's cancer or not is them just behind the scenes, who you may or may not talk to. So I came to appreciate that they're incredibly knowledgeable and they have to know everything. And yet we don't see them as much as we maybe could.
An autopsy is like the best anatomy lesson one could ever attend. Did it change the way that you understand the human body?
You know, it's strange. It kind of did. By the end of this, and I was not expecting this at all, I mean, I was holding organs. But it's strange to see a liver on the table, because now whenever I like have a drink or something, I can imagine myself so much more clearly as an embodied person who's finite, you know, who has like an end date. And they all told me this too, that the cliche is true, that they all feel more connected to life by virtue of the fact that they see death all the time.
Do autopsies just become run of the mill?
They do, because it's your day in, day out job and you have, you know, a script that you follow. But at the same time, there are these moments that they never really completely get past where you realize this is a person on the table and I'm confronting my own mortality. I kind of got them to speak about what brings them back to that sacred place. And they said it's things like when a body comes on the table and it has fingernail polish or a tattoo. And so those little tiny personal things are the things that kind of bring them out of this scientific space and back into the space of life.
It's so interesting. Is it an experience that you'd recommend to anyone else if they have the chance to witness an autopsy?
It's strange to say that I would, because it did change me in a way. And I do like think about it from time to time. We live in a culture now where death, talking about death, you know, any of the ugliness of death is particularly taboo and hidden. Even 100 years ago here in downtown Pittsburgh, where the morgue used to be, they used to have a plate glass window where they display bodies on the slab. And it was for people to ID victims. That was the stated purpose. But allegedly, people would like come by with their prom dates to look at the bodies.
Wowie.
Yeah, and this was true in pretty much all major cities, you know, at the end of the 19th century. Like the Paris morgue was also infamous for this. And so it's really been stripped away from the public space like that. And so they feel privileged to be kind of close to that because it's something that is locked away now. And they're sort of almost the last keeper of it. And so to get to sit in on that when it's something that we just, I mean, I guess we do on NCIS, but in a sort of not fictionalized way, interact with it. It was a privilege to get to see that along with them.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that experience with us.
Oh, thank you.
Rachel Wilkinson, she's a Pittsburgh-based writer who wrote about attending an autopsy for The Atlantic. You can find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please write a review or tell a friend about it. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.